So, Anthony Catino, Mike Stahl, welcome to the show. Anthony, you're in Delaware. Mike, you're in California. Screenwriters, filmmakers. Tell me a little bit more about who you both are. I mean, I got like a three-way roundtable sort of going on this time, but that's fine. Tell me a little bit more about each of you guys, what you do, what you've been up to.
Mike, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Mike Stahl. I'm a writer, director, producer. I mostly been working in the horror genre, but branching out into thrillers and other areas, and just working on getting a bunch of different projects developed. And I have my first feature, Caps Crossing, came out a couple years ago, and we made a sequel that's now with Lionsgate. We just delivered it to them, so just waiting to see when it's going to come out.
Anthony?
I'm a screenwriter. That's what I've been doing for like the last 4 or 5 years, and I have been working very hard at it, entering contests. I do a lot of shorts. I love writing shorts, but I write features too. I write TV. Mike and I have a project going right now, which is probably what we'll cover some of today, I imagine. I did rewrote, and hopefully I'll get the writing credit for a film for an Indian producer director, which should be coming out soon. It was a Curry Western, probably come out later this year. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. Not sure I'll understand it. If I mean, it'll be in Hindi, but I'm hoping we'll get an English subtitle or something. But we have a lot of stuff going on. I also have another company. I mean, I have a production company called High Bar Media, which I don't really want to talk about today because it is unrelated to thriller screenwriting, that kind of stuff. But it is a result of the whole virus thing. My business partner and I, we had to close our business in December, and we started this other venture, which maybe we'll talk about another time. But
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you said curry western. I guess it, just like spaghetti westerns come from Italy, curry westerns coming from India.
it's exactly what it is. That's what it is. It was a trip. I loved working with the producer. He was a great guy. We're still good friends, and once it comes out, I can talk more about it, but he was very helpful in, let's put it this way, I learned a whole nother aspect of screenwriting by working with him because he's also a director, and it helped me see the story and write it. I write better because of that experience, and I give him a lot of credit for working with me. I mean, we really enjoyed working together. We did some great work, and hopefully it'll come out on screen. But you never know. What you write may not be what you get.
And so Mike, you can maybe help me with this a little bit, especially with the quarantine. I want to say in the last year and a half, obviously quarantine, COVID, and all that stuff. I've seen a lot of anthology films, and I've seen a couple of streaming networks, especially Shudder. I know you guys delve in a lot of suspense and horror. Shudder and Hulu have been putting out shorts, so there is a market for that. But outside, that bigger market is anthology films, and so there's a way to get shorts produced, but three to four shorts produced kind of back to back, and then kind of put into an anthology film like Books of Blood, VHS. There was a whole series of films called VHS, but within VHS there was three short films within each movie. And so I actually have a script that's three and a half shorts, one super short, one that kind of ties the other three together. and I'm and I you know pass it on to a couple of partners of mine, you know, hoping to get that produced. But maybe Mike, you know, shed some light on what is the possibilities for these anthology films to, or even just shorts. Will there ever be kind of a market, with the exception of maybe this short-term quarantine new normal, for shorts?
Yeah, you know, I've made quite a few shorts. I co-produced a short with gosh, I'm totally blanking right now.
Linda? Was it Linda?
Yeah, with Michael Gross from Family Ties. And it was like a 22-minute film about Alzheimer's and dementia and stuff like that. And really just tremendous work by him. But, you know, in a way, those kind of films are, you know, that was made about 6 years ago, or 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, you never really expect to make money from shorts. But now, I think, like you mentioned, Shudder and stuff like that, there are outlets. I think you can make shorts, and you might be able to actually get them out there and have somebody be interested in them more than they might have in the past. And if you can string some pieces together, such like you said, an anthology, especially if it's contained within these, you know, this times that we've been facing, just because of all the testing and COVID concerns and all the stuff that you have to do as a producer to get a film made, which is kind of why Anthony and I started out making a really super contained thriller that we're working on making now, called The Skeleton Ledger. And that was just kind of like, how can we shoot? And, you know, we were really impressed with what some of the folks did on Host.
Host, yeah.
It was, and we said, well, that's interesting too. And we also kind of incorporated the real-time nature of a film, and kind of make it, it doesn't feel like a traditional three-act thing. It just feels more like a whole event occurring before your eyes in real time. So, yeah. And I think filmmaking and the opportunities are kind of changing in that area for that. And like, you know, just kind of round back to what you talked about with the anthology stuff. I mean,
well, there's an Oscar category for it.
Yeah.
And so that's what boggles my mind, is that, okay, you win an Oscar for short, and now what?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was never really, I still don't know there's a giant opportunity to try to be financially benefited by that, except for it might be a calling card and get you attention so that you can make other things you want to make.
There's,
and
even
that's
like
why I make shorts.
There's so. Even like this. There's even the short documentary category, I think, at the Oscars. And so, okay, so I won an Oscar for a short film, narrative, comedy. So that's a gateway for to sell the feature version of the script, and then that gets made. Will that get nominated yet again? So now the short version of tell me the name of your film again, the film that you two are working on.
Oh, Skeleton Ledger.
Skeleton Ledger. So the short version of Skeleton Ledger wins an Oscar in 2018, and then the feature length version of Skeleton Ledger wins an Oscar in 2022. And so
I guess that could happen. I'm not sure if it would, but I guess it could happen. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned, and I just recalled that one of the folks that helped helped us make the deal with Lionsgate, he has an Oscar for a short film. And so his name is Phil Goldmine. Goldfine, sorry. And he helped us make the deal, and he has an Oscar for that. And he pipelines a lot of films to Lionsgate every year, and he's very successful. So that probably helped him out a lot.
Yeah, there's the win for the short film that won an Oscar. I mean, it's getting that, getting into that position and being able to work, make films happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Cause I remember what I noticed, I don't know how many years ago watching, I was watching one of the Oscars and I can't remember what year it was, but there was a short film that was nominated that had Frasier's wife from Cheers, that, that actress was in it. Do you guys remember who I'm talking about?
The character was Lilith.
The actress who played Lilith was in this short film. And then that short film was nominated for an Oscar. I don't remember if it was, if it won. Now, this was years ago. And that's what kind of stuck in my mind. And also back going, you know, cause we all know me going back to Western, not Westerns, going back to, oh, maybe we will go back to Westerns. Going back to shorts, Napoleon Dynamite was picked up by a short. I forget what the goofy name of the short version of that film was, but Napoleon Dynamite was greenlit because he made a short film version of it. Bottle Rocket with Owen and Luke Wilson was greenlit from a short. I know I'm missing some. Hardcore Henry was a bunch of POV action shorts shot and released on YouTube. And so they greenlit a feature length version. And then really they just stuck those original films kind of into the big film and made it a whole feature film. But
Guillermo del Toro flipped a short into a feature. Was it Mama? No, it was a horror.
It was Devil's. It was Devil's Backbone. It was something about the demonic kid.
Yeah, maybe something like that. I forget the name of it, but I watched. I remember watching the short, and it was like, wow, this is pretty freaky. So yeah, I can see why he picked it up. You know, I can't remember the title of it, but yeah, it was interesting.
And did you guys ever watch Bravo? Back in the 90s, the channel Bravo, before it became just reality shows. So back, I want to say in like 95 or 96, Bravo was from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Bravo was independent films, foreign films with no commercials. And then from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., it was like a nun and a priest and like it was religious readings and stuff like that. So Bravo was only for 12 hours of the day, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And they would show a foreign film, an independent film or whatever, no commercials. But say that film is an hour and 45 minutes. They got 15 minutes of something. They would play shorts. They would play music videos. Usually it was shorts. And that was like the one market I remember back then to feature, you know, short films and stuff like that. So, and this was years ago. This was, I want to say, in the mid 90s, because then they started showing. Then Bravo was 24/7. Then Bravo just took over whatever that time slot was, they took that over for the whole 24 hours, 24/7. Then they started delving into more mainstream indie or more mainstream international films, and then turned into Bravo as we know it today.
I think that's interesting. You know, they did try to do Quibi, which I thought was an interesting idea, but I think they may have been a little ahead of their time. I think they just couldn't get the subscriptions from enough of younger people to sustain it. And, well, and those things were super short and it was a little bit different, and it is digestible, but it also was kind of built in a bingey kind of way. So you'd really want to watch the next episode or whatever.
Sort of. Now what
killed the ones that I saw? Yeah.
Well, what killed Quibi was quarantine. People were staying home and watching on their big screens, and they didn't want to watch movies in this aspect. Now you could do both.
Yeah.
Right. But Quibi is more for people at work. I'm going to watch a real quick, 15 minute episode of The Fugitive with Kiefer Sutherland. They're at work, and so boom, or they're in their car, they're stuck in traffic. Quibi came out just as quarantine, and I've got, you know, 3 60-inch TVs. I got 5 other, you know, smaller Fire TVs, and it's now I'm staying home, catching up on everything I didn't get to watch for the past 5 years, 6 years, and it's cinematic movies, TV shows, that we're known for, that we're used to for the last 10, 15 years. And it's not the new Quibi. Now, had quarantine not happened, Quibi might be a different story, but people were stuck home souping up, if not enjoying, they're souping up their home entertainment centers.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You know, historically, it didn't work out too well for them.
Yeah.
I think they might have kept it going a little bit longer. I think also a lot of younger folks are used to getting stuff for free and don't necessarily have money.
Right. I mean, that's TikTok. What, TikTok that's is what just like Quibi, and TikTok's free.
Yeah, and that's what I found when I first really started promoting the first feature I made, Caps Crossing, was that there were a lot of interested 20-somethings who were in college or whatever that wanted to watch it. But we were on Amazon, and you know, they can't afford an Amazon subscription. So they're like, well, where can I watch it? And then we kind of saw it explode for those folks who don't have subscription services when we sent it over to Tubi, which is now Fox bought them. And we just saw the numbers just shoot up because it was the right positioning for the, you know, the demographic and the folks there. And so the viewership just went up huge because of that, because, you know, they only have a limited amount of income too, which I think was a factor. So,
yeah.
Ooh, Tubi?
No, the 20 somethings who are in college, they're working a job, classes and stuff like that. And, you know, they might piggyback on their parents' Amazon or Prime account or Netflix or something. But if they don't have that, I mean, they're going to be very discerning when they choose what they're going to spend their money for a subscription.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, yeah.
So, Anthony, tell me a little bit more about Skeleton. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting it.
The Skeleton Ledger.
Skeleton Ledger. So, Anthony, tell me more about the Skeleton Ledger.
Mike, how much will you want to disclose?
the first 5 pages.
You probably do the setup.
Just the first 5 pages, maybe.
Well, it as Mike said, I mean, the film opens. It's essentially a real time film. Similar shot, similar to Unfriended,
mm-hmm.
or Host
or Searching. Did you ever see Searching? Searching was, yeah.
No, I didn't see that one. There's only so many hours in the day, you know.
Yep.
So,
yep.
No, but I did watch the other two, Host and Unfriended. And when Mike originally brought it up, like, hey, you know, what do you think about this? Have you seen the movie Host? And I was like, no, I haven't. So I watched it, and it was like, to me, it was intriguing because, you know, I have 2 sons. They're in their 20s, and they're right in the demographic for this type of film. And they're on their phones constantly. And I mean, I avoid the phone as much as possible, but everybody's got a phone. Everybody's used to looking at, you know, something, some video, TikTok, whatever. But with respect to a film, when you're shooting it in that format, being a little bit older, you're not used to seeing it, but especially with the lockdowns and all that stuff, like what we're doing right now. I mean, we're doing an interview in a Zoom meeting, and this is like commonplace now. This is just like standard way of doing anything. I mean, it's the way we do business now too. I prefer doing business face to face, but hey, you know, we do what we have to do. At the end of the day, audiences are used to this type of format. And at first I wasn't really convinced with it, but when I watched Host and Mike and I discussed it at length, it's like, you know, there's a way to do this, but let's, I mean, it's been done in horror. more than once. Let's do something different. And so we were kicking around ideas the first week of February. How about this? How about that? And one thing led to another. And let's just say that the headlines really kind of drove it. The whole Jeffrey Epstein thing really caught our interest, and sex trafficking, human trafficking, child kidnapping, all this stuff just kind of got wrapped up. And so we constructed a concept essentially around that. And since everybody hates one percenters, we made them all the bad guys. So we have to have,
aren't they all? Aren't they really? I mean, it's kind of based on.
Yeah. You know, and the funny thing is we're all trying to become one percenters too. Oh, somehow.
You know it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not all of them are bad. I mean, not everybody who has money is bad, but there are people who got their wealth in bad ways, or they use their positions of power to cover up their misdeeds. And that's kind of like, you know, the skeleton ledger is based off of kind of, you know, skeletons in people's closet, and the ledger is, somebody who has a digital log of all these people's activities. And, a father who discovers that he calls some.
You want the log line?
Yeah.
The log line is an enraged father blackmails a group of one percenters who he said had sex with his underage daughter at their elite sex club. But his plan backfires when the daughter confronts the group.
Oh, shit.
So basically, you know, he calls them all to a meeting.
It's definitely an oh shit kind of film. we've peppered it with a great many twists. Circling back around to what you just said, you know, one thing about having the kind of money that a lot of these people have who participate in this kind of stuff, if you think about Jeffrey Epstein and the types of clients that he had, flying here, flying there, private jets, Caribbean island, all these places are all set up. What's ubiquitous is the anonymity. They're all anonymous. I mean, well, I shouldn't say that. When you see somebody, you know, at one of these places where they congregated, you know who they are. But otherwise, everybody's anonymous, and they pay for that anonymity. So my thinking has always been, the wealthier you are, the more anonymity you can buy.
Mm-hmm. Or silence.
And the worst thing in the world is losing that anonymity. That's what we have at the center of the conflict in this, because there are pictures taken in a place with this girl, it's this father's daughter, and those pictures were not supposed to have been taken. No one knows where they came from, and it's like, how did this happen? And you have five characters who are elite, prominent people who are about to be disclosed. You know, it's about to go out in the open. And the blackmailer is really got them by the short hairs. So there's a big scramble.
Yeah. And you know, I always love stories like that. I've always been working on this idea. If you have these people that have so much money, so much power, that you, at some point in their lives, they make this choice in life to either go the route of Superman or the route of Lex Luthor.
Right.
And Lex Luthor, with all his genius and all his money and all his influence and all his power, if he had chose that for good, and there's always, and I've always been kind of, and it kind of goes back to the superheroes and the whole mythology of gods and superheroes and titans and the choices they make. And there's a version of Superman called Red Son, where he landed in Russia, not Smallville. And Russia, communist Russia, brought him up, and he's this Russian super weapon. But he landed in Smallville, and he was raised by small town farmers, Martha and Jonathan Kent. And he was taught, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the American values, the American values that we believe should be right. And that's he could walk into any building. He could kill anybody he wanted. He could take over any country, any planet he wanted. But Superman chose to do what he did. He made that choice, even based on his upbringing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so there's always that. So going back to this skeleton ledger, I always think of these elites. You have so much money, you have so much power, and this is what you choose to do with it. You have to have that extra thing. Joining a hard target club. Oh, I have to, you know, I'm done with the safaris. Man, if I could kill an actual human being because I can afford it and have that anonymity. That anonymous identity, whatever. Yeah. But that secrecy. And to have sex with a girl that's 16. Ooh, man, I've already done that. Have sex with a girl that's 14. Ooh, I've already done that. And so on. And it's like, because I can afford it and I can be secret about it, or I can take these trillions of dollars that I have in my wallet and I could eliminate all this shit from the planet. And I could help these countries with these, you know, skeletally starving babies. Instead of, just going to chill on a Caribbean island. I own my own island. Bill Burr was making fun of the guy who I think owns Nestle and wanted to control all the bottled water. Oh, and
they do.
Bill Burr did this whole bit where he was like impersonating one of those 1905 oil barons. He's like, I want all the water. I want to control the rain. I want to control the atmosphere. And he was like doing this whole bit. And it's like, yeah, man, these freaking guys think that way.
I think it's twofold, right? You could choose like, oh, I have all this money. They call it FU money. Mm-hmm. You have it. And it's like, we all as people always strive for the next level or something else. We want to do something new or whatever. And, you know, sometimes people have natural, let's call them proclivities to do bad things. We're not all perfect, but when you have money and power, it enables you to be able to indulge yourself in those things easier. And you also find kindred spirits that can help enable you and do that. I mean, that's why the way you say you have to just keep next leveling it, right? It's like you run out of things. That's why you have Elon and Branson and Bezos. They all want to go spaceships and stuff like that. That's a lot more honorable than some of the other
stuff. Way more honorable, because that is a stepping stone for you and I.
Yeah,
you know, Joe Schmo to get on a passenger plane to the moon or something. That's a stepping stone.
Yeah.
And there's no anonymity to that. They broadcast the whole thing. As far as we know,
those guys are perfect either. There may be tons of stuff about them we don't know, because there's not a human on this earth that's perfect. But we don't know everything about them. So, I mean, but, you know, given the chance, if you come into money all of a sudden, what are you going to do? Because people are like, you feel invisible in some ways, and you can do whatever you want. And, you know, that's kind of how we come to the same. And you become comfortable in that skin too, especially if you're around other people who feel the same way. So it's just like the kind of people you surround yourself before you have, if you have money or not, it really makes a difference and an impact on your life. So what were you going to say, Anthony?
Well, these guys, I mean, you mentioned Musk, you can look at Branson, you can look at Bezos. There's, when you get to their level, I mean, I try to look at everything in terms of human nature, you know. You have egos at play, massive egos. There's no disputing that. You watch any one of their interviews or anything on YouTube, you can just tell. So then it becomes competition between titans,
yeah.
Right? Who can get to the moon first? Who can get to outer space first? And, you know, there's always, there's these history-making things are always by these types of competitions. The thing I find ironic about all of these guys or any of these elites, and I'm not talking you have to be mega wealthy like Bezos or Branson or any of these guys. I'm talking about like prominent people, whether it's politicians or people in the news or this and that. And that's what we have incorporated in the story. Our five characters here are ensemble cast. They're prominent people. They're not billionaires. Well, one is, but the rest aren't. You know, they're up and coming wealthy people. And yet
they have power. Yeah.
That's the thing. They control
on the world. Yeah.
Exactly. And the irony to the whole thing is all of these people, their lives are online. Mm-hmm. You can find not our characters, of course, they're fictional, but all these prominent people, anybody who was involved with Epstein and people like him, they're public figures even. You can Google them. You can look them up. You can find out where they went to school, where they were born, where they live, you know, their phone number, their agent, their manager, their this, their that, whatever. There's tons of information out there. But the secrets remain anonymous. They remain anonymous in order to keep their secrets. The things that they can afford to do that they don't want anybody to know about. Which circles back around also, of course, to privacy, which is also addressed here. They thought they were doing something in a private room where these things weren't going to be recorded or photographed or anything of the sort. So,
yeah.
You know, I think you could look at any one of these people. You have this public face, and then you have the private face. And mm-hmm. that line is where the money comes in, because their public face makes the money to pay for the things they do in private.
Yeah. You know, going back to what yeah, absolutely. And going back to what you were saying, egos equals competition. I've seen it on film sets where you got, you know, artistic designers, you know, stepping over a director's toes or an AD's toes, and it's because of ego. And it's like, it's not a competition, it's cooperation. At the end of the day, right. At the end of the day, we're making a film. I worked on a music video that was kind of like an extended music video, kind of like what Michael Jackson did with Thriller. We did like a 10 minute short almost for a music video. And the DP was difficult to work with. And I said, dude, at the end of the day, it's going to say written and directed by me. It's going to say director of photography, you can talk all the trash you want. Give your input. I might take it. I might not. But at the end of the day, you're only going to get one credit and I'm getting three. So, I mean, you can work with me or I can go find somebody else. Because you're doing too much. It's not a competition, it's cooperation. The mm-hmm. same with the military. You got E4s. I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with the military, but I'm an E6 in the Army National Guard, and there's E4s, there's E3s, E4s, E5s, being competitive. And I'm like, you're wasting your time. I've already made rank. I'm already an E6. You're wasting your time competing with me. I've already won. Right. And I don't even bother competing with other E6s.
Like, that's the thing. It's about, you know, in just about any endeavor, especially filmmaking, I had to learn. Filmmaking taught me so much that I can't do it all. And you have to rely on the talents and skills of other people. You know, when I did a lot of things and I did it all. But until I made a film, that's when I really realized I needed people that were good at what they do and can work with other people and they can do it. And it was really a life-changing experience for me because it made me grow. And, you know, you only have a finite amount of time. You build a camaraderie kind of like you would in the military. I wasn't in, but my dad was for 20 years and I understand it. You're not going to die together, but you have to make it work no matter what. You have 2 weeks to do something and everyone has to pull together to make it. And that's where you have to collaborate and work together mm-hmm. and get it done. And then everybody benefits in the end, especially if it turns out really well. But if you've got individuals, and I say individuals who are not being part of the whole, then you have a real problem. And I've experienced that too. And it just does not work out well. It kills morale, all those kinds of things. So it's very important that everybody's together on
something. It's wasting money, wasting time. Mm-hmm. And me as an AD, it's like, dude, I don't care, man. I'm making my day.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Right.
I got a key grip and I got a cinematographer button heads over the shot. Okay, cinematographer, you win. Let's go make the shot.
Right.
I mean, we can go on Wikipedia and look at the hierarchy of these positions. I was a first AD on an independently produced pilot, and I got the key grip button heads with the DP. And I was like, do you want me to pull this shit up on Wikipedia? All right, you win. Let's go get the shot done now. Hurry up!
Right.
And then they're like, "Oh, you're not silent." They're like, "No, I'm not, man. Like, just pick the gear up, grip it, grab it." Like, no offense. I mean, I'm not being a dick about it. You know, I'm not, you know, key grips are important and every single position, but there is a hierarchy.
Right.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, like.
Yeah. And you know, the DP's setting up the shot and he's like, I want a light here and I want diffusion and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, sometimes they might have a suggestion on a better way to go. But that's as far as it should go. I mean, when it starts becoming a whole thing, starts burning your time on set, it doesn't work.
And you just touched upon another thing. You know, I got family and friends that I've had some family and friends say, I can't take criticism. I can take criticism. I can take criticism very easily. I think your films are too violent. Okay. So you should not make them so violent. No, I don't think so. You can't take criticism. I took your criticism. I considered it. I'll take your criticism into consideration. Considered it.
The funny thing is when people offer criticism like that, they expect you to accept it, but that's not really it. You have the option to reject the criticism.
Yeah.
I don't have to accept it. I considered it, but I'm not accepting it. I took the criticism. I took it like a champ. Yeah. Okay, point made. Still going to be a lot of foul language and a lot of nudity and a lot of violence. That's, you know, maybe not that, but you get my...
It's funny you mentioned that because I shared this with Mike not long ago. I wrote a short titled Neighbor Versus Neighbor. It's won a couple of awards. And it's essentially about the whole mask thing. I wrote it at the beginning of the whole lockdown last, like, March, April. And I received some feedback from a big festival, a big one in LA. And the person that wrote the feedback, I couldn't believe what I was reading because clearly this person this is when the whole Black Lives Matter thing was rolling around, all this stuff. It wasn't even feedback. That's the point. It wasn't feedback. This is some reader's personal criticism of how I portrayed just two characters. There's only five, six characters in the whole story. Two of them, they pointed out, they didn't talk about the illegal immigrant who ratted everybody out. They didn't talk about anybody else except two characters. And it was a personal criticism. I will never put a script into their contest again. Never. Because that's bogus. You don't, you know, if you go and enter a script into a contest, you're expecting feedback, then you expect to get professional feedback, all right? The structure, the characters, the this, the that. But in this case, not at all. I won't even repeat what they said, but the short end of it was, they said, if you rewrite it, they wrote, when you rewrite it, do this, don't do that. And they told me exactly how I should frame those two characters so I don't promulgate negative stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Okay, I took their criticism like you did and rejected it.
Well, listen, I mean, that almost gives you the option to completely write a new script that they might pick up and you have a whole different movie.
Yeah.
But
probably not.
But listen, I'm not going to write Saw and I'm not going to submit it to Disney Plus for distribution.
No.
You don't have to take your script to this contest or this festival or your film to this festival or this network. You know, and the whole goal is to get the film sold or picked up or optioned or, you know, whatever today's terminology is. So I would go to, mm-hmm. I would go to that source. I would go those avenues that I know would better my chances.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I'm only talking about a contest here. That's all. About a contest and actually, right when that pandemic rolled around, when that whole thing first started, I watched a great film called The Lives of Others. It's on Amazon, won an Oscar mm-hmm. for Best Foreign Film. It's about East German Stasi guy.
This guy's the guy listening to microphones, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Outstanding movie. Outstanding. And then I watched that, and then I look at what's going on, and the parallels were just too good. I mean, this is like insane. This is the same. So that's how I came about writing that short, and it's really kind of a proof of concept for something larger. But, you know, circling back around, when you're talking about feedback or criticism, I'll send something to Mike and say, okay, give me some feedback. And he'll tell me, like, you know, this, this, and this. You need to look at this or that, whatever, and some of my peers. But when you send it off to a contest, you're paying for feedback. You really expect professional feedback. But in that case...
And you know what? And you hit the nail on the head. You paid for that submission.
Yes.
I'm not paying for, you know... feelings. I'm paying for, you know, professional I'm paying for professional criticism. Is this a marketable film? Is this
marketable. It's like, you know, was it structured right? Were the characters this, the character whatever, they're going to come back for feedback. That's the challenge. It's like, you're paying for it, so okay, don't give me your personal opinions. See, I don't want your personal opinion.
That's the trick though.
Yeah,
that's the trick though, because you're gonna have senior citizens going to see the movie in the theater, and they're gonna hate it. But you might have teenagers going in there and loving it. So it's still it regardless of that fee, it's so tricky when it comes to critics or reviews or audience engagement.
Yeah, you can't please everybody. It's like you said. I mean, somebody's like, "How do you make films like this?" I mean, I'm not a violent person. I don't want to kill people. But you know, it happened.
You don't?
No. But you know, horror movies is where it kind of comes out. And you know, there's also, I've kind of gotten a lot of people to see that. You know, there's morals and stories underneath it that really matter. It's a different medium to present a message or how something looks or whatever, but these things we talk about, we shouldn't hide them either. Like skeleton legs, right. We shouldn't hide from these things and not talk about them and not show people as they are. We need to show people as they really are and the world as it is sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I have a couple uplifting drama stories and stuff like that. Unfortunately, you know, kind of what I see is what's wrong with the world and kind of seeing, you know, maybe giving people insight into what's going on and maybe get some kind of message or something in there. And if they get it, fine. If they don't, fine. If they're entertained, fine. If they don't like it, everyone's going to like what you do. But yeah, I've had the questions like, why do you make films like this? And it's, I loved horror films. I never saw myself having enough ideas to make horror films. And now I have a million. Because it kind of wasn't where I was focused. My sweet spot is I really love thrillers and some other things. But you know, those are a little more expensive to make and we're moving there now because that's what we're working on with the Skeleton Ledger. And that's where I like to be. And even when we were talking to some distributors about Wrong Side of Dead, which is the Caps Crossing follow-up, people are like, this is horror, but it's a really good thriller too. And that's, you know, it's complex and there's some things people don't want to hear or talk about in there, or people say it's taking inside voices from people and bringing them out sometimes to an extreme. So maybe people kind of go, oh, hey, you know, so I don't do anything to be gratuitous, but there's also folks that want to see horror movies. And I know like, oh, wow, that was a really good slashing or something like that. I mean, it's not like we want to go slash people, but it's like from an artistic sense, you always just say, oh, that's pretty cool. I've never seen it done that way before. And it's cool. You know, yeah. The same way as some people throw, I don't know, shit against a canvas and say, nobody's thrown shit against a canvas like that before. And that's cool.
So. Right. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this, the biggest part, you know, of getting that quote feedback and is I was told how to write my characters. That's what pissed me off the most. And any screenwriter should not be told how to write their characters.
Agreed.
You know,
I will definitely agree with that.
You know, you write it like you see it, like you feel it. And, you know, I always go back to Quentin Tarantino there. He's got a quote that I had to share with somebody not long ago. You know, he demands that he writes his character the way he sees them. He's true to that character. Mm-hmm. And to be told that you can't write a character this way or that way, it's like, go away.
Yeah.
I don't even pay attention to that stuff anymore. And sadly, screenwriters are being told to write in a certain way or write a character this way, write a character that way, which brings me all the way back around to that movie, The Lives of Others. I mean, do we want to live in East Germany where we have some authority saying, you need to write about this, you need to write about that, and you need to write it in such and such a way, and you need to use this music because it's such and such music. You know, that's not a way, you know, if it goes that way, and sadly, I think it's moving in that direction, where's cinema as an art? Where's filmmaking as an art form anymore when you're told to produce and write on certain subjects? Your characters have to be this way. They have to do that. That art is lost.
Here's the thing, though. What you're saying is that only the truly unique and new and refreshing things actually cut through the clutter and actually make an impact and maybe make a ton of money. I mean, Host is an example. Circumstances and they took, you know, found footage sort of film and put a little twist on it because we were all on Zoom meetings. I mean, it's interesting because I was using Zoom intensely for a year before, because I did pre-production and all the way up for my film, because all my folks were in LA and I was up in Northern California. So we use Zoom every day to do pre-production and stuff. And back to that point is, they did something a little bit different. Just like, you know, and those are the things that pop through, and but nobody knows it until it happens. No, you're going to send in something that's unique and different. People are like, I don't like it because I've never seen this before and it doesn't kind of fit in and kind of what I'm used to. But when it actually gets made and comes out, and maybe the public absolutely falls in love with it for one reason or the other, then boom, then you've created a new paradigm, like found footage was with Blair Witch and stuff like that. I mean, that movie was really hard to watch because of the camera work, but it was so different.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you can find that lightning in a bottle and do it, but no one's going to tell you it's good until more people accept it. And it's because people play within their wheelhouse. And I get that. You know, sometimes you're gonna gamble when you make a risk and take a risk and do something like that. But then you just have, if you have enough conviction in it, you make it and you see if it works out or not.
You know, and going, yeah, exactly. And going back to Tarantino's characters, I watched the extended version of The Hateful Eight on Netflix, which they kind of released as a series. It's like 4.5 hours, right? Or 4 or 5 hours, yeah. 5 hour version of it. And I don't know if it was in the theatrical version, but Sam Jackson was the major whatever. And he claimed, and he had this letter from Abraham Lincoln, you know, like he was pen pals with Abraham Lincoln. And spoiler alert, and spoiler alert to anybody who hasn't seen this, but as it turns out, it was fake. He faked it as a way, and the whole moral of the story was, being black, he needed a tool to weaken the white people's preconceived notions of him or something like that. And I'm totally butchering what he said. But as far as Tarantino goes, to have made that whole thing a fraud, that letter from Abraham Lincoln, he made that whole thing a fraud because it was real, it was different. It completely changed not only your perception of Sam Jackson's character, but it also hits you in the face what was really Sam Jackson's character was dealing with in those times. And it was like a double punch to the face to have Sam Jackson.
Accepted him because of that letter. They're like, yeah. Oh, wait.
They sorted it, yeah.
Yeah, and that was a wonderful film. I got to see it in 70 millimeter on a big screen the way, you know, when it first came out. And then I watched the same thing on Netflix too, the extended.
Yeah. And that extended version really, really blew me away. I thought it was a completely new, unique way to see that film. And I liked all the extended stuff. And I think I finished it in a day. But it was... And so going back to like these moments in films that you do not see coming, and maybe the person that criticized your script, Anthony, would have been appalled by that. But that's not the point. It's supposed to appall you. I've done my job. It's supposed to appall you, and it's supposed to shock you. And it's supposed to say, holy shit, this guy has to go to such levels to not get fucked with. Yep. And then when you realize what he did, then you realize what he's been having to deal with. And he had to fraudulently write up a letter from the president. I mean, I don't know what kind of charge that is. If you're going to, I mean, nowadays you're just going to get some bad social media press or something, but I don't know what kind of fraud that was back then. That might've been treason of some sort to have fraudulently written up a letter from the president or something. I don't know.
It might have been. Yeah.
I'm not sure they had handwriting experts then.
And plus, you know, he had passed away, so they would have to.
Yeah. I think it's interesting is though that's a very contained film. 90% of it takes place in the coterie or whatever I think it's called.
Haberdashery.
Haberdashery.
Yeah. Minnie's haberdashery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's so, but there's so much conflict and tension, and but it's all created by the characters and who they are, mm-hmm. and what they want, and what their goals are, and what their weaknesses are, and you see those all come into play, and that's a perfect example of his particular character. And then each one of those people, you know, their undoing was for different reasons, but their characters were. I didn't think any of them were necessarily. None of them were perfect. Some of them may be likable for different reasons, but none of them are perfect and they're flawed. And, you know, that's what all the whole, it's kind of amazing when you think about that. That's a 3-hour movie that takes place inside one little tiny room.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we've been working towards in terms of, you know, one of the topics that you wanted to cover was, you know, how we're dealing with this whole, you know, current events and stuff like that. One of the things that Mike and I have been discussing and how to figure out is, you know, what other contained movies can we put together that haven't been seen before, or, you know, different kinds of movies. Personally, I'd like to do a Western, you know. Everybody's like poo-poos Westerns, but you know what? If there's a good Western, it generally makes money. And so, yeah, there's a couple of concepts on the table for doing a contained Western.
Yeah, and we already started working on a sequel that's contained as well. It only has like
the sequel to the Skeleton Ledger. We started on that, and it starts off with some big twists. So. It turns everything on its head.
Yeah. You know, going back to
right now,
going back to contained films, I always, so Hateful Eight's very contained, you know, but the Hateful Eight is actually a remake in a way to The Thing. Tarantino admitted that, Hateful Eight is a remake of sorts, a Western 18 something, no alien version of The Thing. And there's even the shot where in The Thing that, in the movie, The Thing comes up out of the floor, and he did that slow shot of, the brother coming out of the cellar from the floor. And then of course he flips it, the guy gets his head blown off or whatever. But, you know, back in the 80s, there was a lot of contained films. I've always talked about Predator. There was that big scene where they hit that little Cuban refugees, or they were militant refugees or something, and they had the big shootout. But for the whole rest of the film, five guys lost in the woods and a gal and a predator. Mm-hmm. Seven cast members steadily diminishing to the, I think, you know, the last 30 minutes of Predator is just Arnold and the creature. Predator was definitely a contained film. Breakfast Club. Great example. The first Alien contained film. Breakfast Club. And I always thought of those films, and even way before the pandemic, I was always trying to figure out, you know, I see these filmmakers making these independent films, these micro budget contained films with extraordinary stories. Swingers, kind of a contained film. I mean, Saw, definitely a contained film. Blair Witch, we touched upon.
See,
Blair
here's Witch. The thing. One thing that ties all of those together is the setting or location, because that becomes part of the conflict. The woods in Predator, Saw, a room which could be like anywhere, but it was pretty nasty if memory serves me correctly. The first one.
Yeah.
All of these have a setting that contributes to the conflict.
Yep.
And that's what really sets them apart.
Yeah.
Because you need that, otherwise.
Like Hateful Eight, they're trapped in the haberdashery. Alien, they're trapped in the plane. The Thing, they're trapped there on that base. Breakfast Club, they're trapped in the school.
Trapped in the library.
They're trapped, and that's where you're right. The setting and the circumstances.
Reservoir Dogs. And Reservoir Dogs is another one. And Reservoir Dogs kind of bounced around to some other locales here and there every once in a while, but they were trapped in the warehouse for 95% of the film. They were trapped in the warehouse. Mm-hmm. And one of the best scenes, I think one of Tarantino's greatest writing and directing, was the commode story from Reservoir Dogs. And it's not so much, I guess it is kind of a confined thing, but, you know, he's obviously, you know, another spoiler alert, who hasn't seen Reservoir Dogs? We'll do a spoiler alert anyway for Reservoir Dogs. But Mr. Orange is an undercover cop.
Right.
And so his partner, who obviously should have been Sam Jackson, that actor should have been Sam Jackson, but it wasn't. But he's giving him this story. So this whole commode scene, his partner gives him this script to memorize. And then and then they show him on the rooftop memorizing it.
Yeah.
And rehearsing it. And then they show him at the strip club with Big Joe and the rest of the crew telling it. Then they cut to him at the train station, walking into the commode. Then they cut to him telling the commode story to the cops that are in the commode at the train station. And the way he broke this down, then that's clearly not kind of that could be done in a more confined, but still today, Tarantino's directorial debut, Reservoir Dogs, that scene and the way he broke that down and kind of experimented with it and kind of broke a lot of rules filmmaking wise. And maybe not broke rules, but just really experimented with what he could pull off with the commode story.
Right.
But again, you know, Reservoir Dogs is a confined film. Everything was in that warehouse. And that's another, and I don't mean to cut you off, Anthony. He admits to that's a remake. Reservoir Dogs is a remake of a Hong Kong action film with Chow Yun-fat called City on Fire. But he made a feature-length film out of a 10-minute scene from City on Fire. And he was able to expound upon, all right, what the hell happened in the warehouse in City on Fire? He made his own film about just what happened in the warehouse. And Mr. White coming in, Mr. Blonde coming in, Mr. Pink coming in.
Right. Right. And the beautiful thing about Reservoir Dogs is that you had each one of these guys, and it's funny you mentioned Reservoir Dogs. We have a reference to it in our script.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that, Mike?
Yeah.
When our blackmailer talks about anonymity, he makes a joke and he does a Reservoir Dogs. Who's the guy that plays Joe? What actor is that? He's dead now.
Oh, jeez.
That older fella.
Yeah, he was. He was Elaine Bennis's father in.
Yes, that guy. I can't think of his name. Anyway, so our blackmailer, he does an imitation of him. Oh, what are you, Mr. White, Mr. Brown, and all this other stuff. But yeah. We do have a reference to that.
Yeah.
There's tons of references in movies about it. They're like, wait, we're not supposed to use our names. You know, when I see that, I always think about Reservoir Dogs because it may not even be where it started, but that's where I reference it from.
And none of these super successful, super popular films have an extraordinarily in-depth story like Saving Private Ryan or Midway or anything like that. What they have is, and going back to what you said, Anthony, it's a location, but it's characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's characters. It's dynamic, interweaving characters dealing with the situation. It could be a super simple story like Swingers. Mikey broke up with his girlfriend for 6 months. Who hasn't gone through that? No, he broke up with his girlfriend. He broke up with his girlfriend for 6 years, and it's been 6 months since they broke up. Who hasn't gone through that? And then he's a struggling actor, and he's out in L.A. looking for the ladies, and he's with Trent, who is a complete maniac when it comes to the ladies and getting drunk and going out and partying. Who hasn't dealt with that? It's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how those two kind of interact, and you got a couple other buddies. Ron Silverman was in it. A couple other guys are in it that are all dealing with them, but it's just Trent trying to help Mikey get over his girlfriend, party, look for gigs. And that's right. Swingers. And that's still today one of my top, 10 films of all time. And then you have Heat, which is an extremely in-depth, detailed, extravagant.
That's with Pacino and De Niro.
And yeah, that is a complex, that is a three-hour complex crime thriller. Extremely complex story. I don't know, 20 to 30 freaking characters. I mean, star-studded cast up and down.
Right.
And that's another top 10 film. And they're completely different.
And they're that's one of the things we have to contend with this. And I think Mike would agree. I mean, these days, in the current environment, trying to secure funding to make a film is a real challenge. It's as hard as writing the film and doing anything else is trying to find the financing to get it done. I mean, we don't need a lot of money to get this film made because it is contained, but it's no easy feat. I myself have run into people who's like, well, if you need $10 million, we don't do anything less than 10, sorry, or, some crazy number. We don't do less than a million and that kind of stuff. It's really difficult. So I told Mike to find ways to increase the budget so we find the money. So,
yeah. But, like I said, going back, even with the 80s, with the big blockbuster 80s, half of them were contained films. And that's what always stuck out in my mind. Five kids trying to find their identity in a school library during Saturday detention. Like, that movie was profound. That movie defined the 80s.
More or less, yeah.
Back to the Future did too, but Back to the Future is this huge, complex time traveling story with 70 different locations. And Breakfast Club is just one with five kids and a douchebag teacher, I guess he was. Disciplinary / teacher,
the dean,
because we could all relate.
He was dean.
We were one of those characters probably, or in high school, or could at least be close to one of them. Yep. And just see the different situations that each one of them are trying to go to, and they're all struggling with life, and that's what you're doing, kind of as a teenager or even as you get older. But it's something every teenager in high school goes through. And I mean, it's one of my all-time favorites because it's just, if it's on, I'll watch it.
Yeah. And so what you have that could be done during quarantine, great soundtrack, because Breakfast Club had a great soundtrack. Shit, man. I mean, people, that song, Don't Forget About Me. I mean, that's still played on the radio today, but a decent soundtrack.
Mike, there you go. There's an idea. We just have like all this kind of music where we need to, spend money on music rights.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer.
Jack up the budget and then we can go get $1 million. Yeah.
Maybe not Hans Zimmer. Maybe Steve Aoki or something. Steve Aoki, do your score and that'll boost it up to past $1 million.
Yeah.
There you go.
So gentlemen, I mean, I know we had a couple of ideas. I mean, we've been going on for a while. Listen, before I let you guys go, we talked about Skeleton Legend. What's next? Let's start with you, Anthony. What's next on the agenda? What's the next set of plans, next set of goals, say for the next year, not counting Skeleton Ledger?
Well, the sequel to Skeleton Ledger, that's in the works. It might even be one of those where it's, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Volume 2, that kind of a thing. Who knows?
Okay.
But we've uncovered some serious plot twists, so we're gonna move forward with the second version or the sequel. Myself, I have a couple writing assignments that are coming up, which I can't really talk about. So that's gonna keep me plenty busy. Plus, I have my other production company, High Bar Media, where we do kids stuff. Children's shows and
High Bar.
We're busy. Yeah, High Bar.
Clean, clean and classy stuff. Yes.
Yeah, we don't have too many Tarantino characters in that at all.
Right.
But I'd like to have them there, but we're not gonna. But no. So that's
you might get another letter.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But you know, that's moving along. We're busy pitching that, and plus I have at least three other features in the works. I have a TV one that I'm busy out pitching now, about a mob bookie. And the proof of concept short that I wrote has gotten a lot of interest in contests. It's done really well. So the character seems to resonate. So I wrote a follow-up to it, and I'm going to probably knit them together and make the first two episodes of a TV series. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. Plus the current script I'm working on, Half Dead Coeds. It's a zombie comedy. So okay.
Half busy. Dead Coeds. Awesome. Awesome. Mike.
Yeah, I'm besides Skeleton Ledger, I have a couple other films that I'm trying to get off the ground. One of them's more of a drama that's inspired by true events, where two white guys and a black guy, under the threat of being expelled from their college, are sent by the dean to go help with black voter registration in the South. And it's a pretty interesting story. You know, I'm staying in the horror vein too. I have a film called Hidden Influence. It's mostly contained in the film. A family moves into a rental home and they become the subjects of an experiment by a paranormal researcher. So that's what I'm trying to get made as well. And a friend of mine who is in Afghanistan kind of started out with an idea, and we're working on that as well, about an army veteran who returns home after deployment, and his life is just in shambles and stuff, and he's trying to get back on track, and his wife leaves him and stuff, and you know, he pretty much ruins his life because he doesn't know how to cope. And then he meets this little autistic boy, and they generate a relationship, and they become very tight knit. And you know, it even comes stronger than the relationship between the guy and then the boy's mother. And then the father gets really jealous, and it kind of heats up from there, because he's found a way to connect with the son in a way that he hasn't been able to. So working on that as well, because I've always had a deep respect for the plight and what folks in our military and the sacrifices they've made for our country, and how they do sometimes struggle when they come home after being deployment, especially in one of these really nasty areas like Iraq, Afghanistan, and even in places we don't talk about too much, in Africa. We don't talk about some of those things that happened there. So that interests me a lot. And I have several other horror films that I'm working on as well. But, you know, my number one thing right now is Skeleton Ledger, trying to get that so we can make it, because we know we can make it for a decent budget and get it done quickly. So that's what we're looking at. But if I find something that investors are interested in, one over the other, I'm going to move to that. That's why I have several kind of projects in the hopper and stuff like that. So,
outstanding. Well, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I mean, we had some other ideas to go over, but you know, I always want to have a previous guest on recurring, so we can always tackle that down the line. But you guys, this was a blast. So again, before I let you go, Anthony, any plugs you want to put out?
Yes. There? Plugs?
Websites.
Oh, yeah, links. Yes. Yeah, anybody who might be interested in taking a look at, I have pretty much, I've made posters for any features, TV, shorts. They're on my website. I slap the awards on them, and you can kind of tool through them and see if anything strikes your fancy. I write edgy thrillers. That's what I specialize in, but I typically pepper them with either comedy or horror or sometimes action if it's needed, but those elements are generally woven into a story here and there. But yeah, I don't do social media, so my website's where it's at.
That's where it's at. Mike, any socials, links, plugs you want to put out there?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say check out Caps Crossing. There's the poster for the first one. The second one's coming out soon. Caps Crossing is on Amazon, Tubi, Microsoft, PlayStation, you name it. It's out on all the digital platforms and stuff like that. The new one's coming out. Hopefully, that would be really cool if it would come out this year, but I don't know. As the days go by, I'm not so sure. I was hoping for an October release, but we'll see for Caps Crossing, Wrong Side of Dead. Just check out MikeStahl.com is my website. And check out the film.
Awesome. Well, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough, man. This was a blast. Don't go anywhere.